Al-Gharib will be cut off from the Saudi-backed forces.
Cutting off the supplies in Al-Rahba would weaken the enemy forces. There is also synchronization in the movement of our forces in the rest of the northern and southern fronts towards the city of Marib, and this constitutes a siege on the city from all sides. All supplies have been cut off from the Saudi-led forces, and they can no longer carry out any military action. Light weapons will be more effective, and the army is now able to advance more towards Harib and Al-Juba.
The Yemeni army has also managed to take control of other military sites overlooking the city of Marib from the western and northern sides, which would help the armed forces continue advancing towards the Harib and Al-Juba areas.
The Yemeni army managed to liberate the entire district of Al-Rahba and cut off the supply routes from Al-Baida. With that, the liberation of Al-Juba and Habri area became easier for the Yemeni army. There is an insistence by the Yemeni army to liberate the city of Marib, especially after the Saudi-led coalition's rejection of Ansar Allah's recent initiative to stop military operations there.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations aimed at liberating the strategic Marib province from the Saudi-backed forces, including terrorist groups. Marib has strategic importance as an oil-rich province. It is the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Yemenis believe that their army will eventually liberate Marib from all foreign powers, including the Saudi-backed forces. They say now Riyadh has to bear the consequences of its disregard for Ansarullah's recent initiative to end the ongoing crisis in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Overnight security clampdown and communications blackout occurred in Indian-administered Kashmir after the region's iconic leader, Syed Ali Shah Gilani, died. The mosques in the region announced the demise. However, Gilani's followers were not able to participate in his funeral prayers.
Every home in Kashmir is mourning this loss. Authorities do not allow anyone to move out of homes. They should not have done this. It was our right to participate in his funeral prayers. After all, India claims to be a democracy. Can't we even mourn?
Officials say people's participation could have resulted in massive law and order problems.
Restrictions
were imposed to keep law and order in place. No untoward incident occurred anywhere during the last 24 hours, and the situation has been peaceful.
Kashmir has witnessed a record number of internet blackouts in the world and is the world's largest militarized zone. Analysts say people of Kashmir have been forced into this silence since India stripped Kashmir of its autonomous status in August 2019.
The silence which was imposed upon the people is a human rights violation. They could not go to attend the funeral of one of the veteran tallest leaders of Jammu and Kashmir, who has all along his life said and advocated about the right to self-determination.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has condemned the Indian government's denial of right to choose burial rituals inside of the Syed Ali Shah Gilani. Observers say people of Kashmir have been forced into a controlled kind of a life where every rule is not set by their choice but by the force of the governing authorities.
Syed Ali Gilani was one of the tallest leaders of the resistance movement of Jammu and Kashmir and was advocating for right to self-determination. He deserved a respectful funeral, but the government did not allow the funeral to happen other than his family members. International covenants and international law says that every person who dies is to be handed over to his family for a choicest burial and a choicest funeral.
People of Kashmir say since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party took a unanimous decision on Kashmir's special status in August 2019, a lot has changed without their consent. They say the silence of international community on the plight of Kashmiri people has added to their miseries, and with each passing day, living in the controlled land is getting difficult for them. And sooner or later, Kashmiri people are going to be the world's new asylum seekers. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
A house was recently bombed by a US drone strike. Shrapnels have even damaged the door of the house. 10 members of a single family, including 6 children, lost their lives in the recent U.S. drone strike. As the relatives of the victims say, the owner of the house, which was targeted by the attack, was an engineer with no ties to any terrorist group. Imal Ahmadi is the brother of the owner of the house. He explains how the U.S. airstrike claimed the lives of his beloved ones in a moment.
I had left the house almost 10 minutes before that U.S. brutal attack. I quickly got back after I received a call from a relative. I saw the dead bodies of my brother, his sons and daughters all over the yard.
Blaming the U.S. for launching blind attacks on civilian areas, Imal is also angry on international journalists and the United Nations for what he says turning a blind eye on their misery.
A number of local and international journalists have so far interviewed us, but no one, including the United Nations, has heard our voice. Everybody follows his or her own agenda with paying no attention to our demand. We want justice, and the UN is responsible.
It was August 30 when the U.S. airstrike hit this vehicle inside a house located in northeastern Kabul. Later, Pentagon said that they have successfully eliminated a vehicle packed with explosives in the city of Kabul. However, Taliban urgently condemned the attack, calling it an inhuman assault on civilians. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Turkey has proposed to the European Union a substantial migrant deal. Turkish Foreign Minister said in a joint presser with Dutch Foreign Minister Sigrid Kaag that this time Turkey will not handle the burden of refugees alone and will need a new deal with the EU, unlike the previous one, where the bloc would only pay a certain amount of money and leave Turkey to handle the rest.
On the issue of the Afghan migrants, there will be no such cooperation if the EU's approach would be based on we give money and you keep them there. We have fulfilled our responsibility. The number of migrants trying to go to Europe has decreased 95%, but the EU did not do its part.
Following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, Turkey tightened its security measures at the borders to prevent the wave of Afghan refugee influx to the country. Previously, the Turkish president said, his country has no duty, obligation, or even responsibility to be Europe's refugee warehouse, assuring that international cooperation is needed to prevent a new migration wave from Afghanistan.
There is an urgent need for a new deal for sure. However, this time the deal will be different than the previous one due to the changes that took place worldwide. Not only is it up to EU and Turkey, but also the United States is involved in the issue of Afghan refugees. Turkey now has closed its borders in front of refugees, not only because a deal is not reached yet, but the burden of refugees is actually affecting the AKP internally as well. People have started to feel the burden of migrants and the country and are now pressuring the government to stop receiving them.
The AKP is under pressure from opposition groups and citizens who are calling for a solution for the increasing number of refugees and foreigners residing in the country, which most likely will affect votes in the upcoming elections. Turkish citizens are complaining from unemployment, high demand on real estate, and other problems caused by the fact that Turkey has become a safe haven to those fleeing crisis-hit countries. The Turkish government now has to make a balance between fulfilling the needs of the EU and international community and surrendering to its own people's demand of sending the already existing refugees back. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
This is IRIB English Radio.
get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. UK state-owned broadcaster, the BBC, has admitted that there were serious flaws in the documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical attack in Syria, 3 years after the incident occurred. Why would the BBC come out now and cast doubt on the accuracies of the findings? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how flawed info such as this led to the US, Britain, and France launching bombing raids in Syria. Did they use flawed intel or fake news to continue the war in Syria?
UK's national broadcaster, the BBC, has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in the Syrian city of Douma contained serious inaccuracies. The program reported that a former inspector with the International Chemical Weapons Watchdog had expressed doubts over the organization's stance on the incident. The watchdog, in its probe into the incident, had blamed it on the Syrian government, a charge Damascus denied. The BBC program claimed the inspector was motivated to go public about his doubts in return for getting financial reward from the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. Now, the British Broadcasting Corporation has accepted that it had no evidence to back up that claim. Also, WikiLeaks has said such a reward was never paid.
The excuse of chemical weapons was used in Syria again and again. In 2012, 2013, it was used for the sanctions on Syria. It was used for the U.S. beginning military actions. The latest expose in Douma in 2018 was at a time when every report said Syria was clearly winning the war. And that was why this massive new level of bombardment, happened. They just found a new story. All of the media used it. Hundreds and hundreds of news articles from every direction screamed about it. And now we find it's just a fabrication.
It's surprisingly rare for the BBC to rule against itself. The recent confession is hailed as a major victory for truth.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have activist, historian, and investigative journalist, who is a former BBC employee, Tony Gosselin, joining us from Bristol. Also joining us, journalist and political analyst, John Bosnich, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both, and I'm going to start with you, Tony Gosselin, if I may. Tell us what has happened here. You have an incident that happened in 2018. Briefly, if you can touch on that for us, and why you think that at this point you have the BBC coming out saying what it's saying in terms of inaccuracies, etc.
So this whole idea of faking weapons of mass destruction attacks It's really, you know, this incident in Douma in 2018, this time a chemical weapon attack supposedly by the President Assad's government, which actually wasn't. I mean, it was all faked. It's very reminiscent, isn't it, of the fake weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was used as the excuse to go in there in 2003 into that illegal war. And basically, we've got a similar situation here, at least an attempt to do the same in Syria, with all these missile strikes that were launched by the French, the British and the Americans straight after this fake news attack, weapons of mass destruction back in 2018. Also, outside international law. So really what we seem to be dealing with here is a bunch of international criminals who want to try to break international law by attacking countries and then persuading their own domestic populations here in the West using the mass media that this is all fine and okay because a certain individual, you know, whether it's Saddam or President Assad, has been using WMD against their own people. Now, you know, the same, of course, was used against Colonel Gaddafi, saying that he was attacking his own people, and that was used as an excuse to attack Libya. So this is really, history repeating itself with the criminals in the West trying to get these wars started. Now, you know, what was the purpose of all of this? Well, it seems to be following the Yinon plan. He was an Israeli general. And he was saying that we need to have all these various attacks on Middle Eastern countries in order to destabilize the Middle East, to balkanize the Middle East. But I think at the end of the day, you know, you could also look upon this as just resource grabs, the attempt of the West with a massive military that it can't really justify to its own population, sitting around. They don't want them twiddling their thumbs, so they want to involve them in invasions. And these media operations are the Trojan horse in the mind of the Western public, which allows them to just get away with criminal acts. And so that's why this is so important. And Peter Hitchens, who's put this complaint into the BBC, myself, I complain to the BBC from time to time. I never hear anything in the national press about it because Peter Hitchens has got a column in the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday. They know that they can't just get away with fudging it. It's journalists like me, real investigative journalists like me, who find that because we don't have much of an outlet, obviously I do here on Press TV, but Press TV's banned in the UK, that we find that that those sorts of complaints to the BBC generally get sidelined or ignored, but they realise they cannot ignore Peter Hitchens' complaint on this occasion. And the big problem with this documentary on the radio, first of all, Chloe Hadjamajul, I mean, can't even pronounce her surname, in the world of journalism in Britain, nobody's ever heard of this woman. She's come out of nowhere to produce this fake news report. But right. What she's been doing is an actual, you know, it's well known in journalism as a line that you should never cross. That is, she has put words into the mouth of her source from the OPCW.
Okay.
And that's really the crux of this complaint, is that the Alex, this guy from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, actually never said what she said he said. So it is fake news, and a worst thing about this particular type of fake news is this is an excuse to start a war. So that's why it's such an important complaint, and well done for Peter Hitchens and the Mail on Sunday for pointing the finger at the BBC as the propagandists they are, and warmongers too, also sure. Trying to include WikiLeaks as part of the scam that they're trying to run. So attacking sure. Real journalists, propagandists attacking the real journalists in Britain.
Right. Well, you mentioned a lot of things there. We're going to get into some of the WikiLeaks stuff and other points that you made there, Tony Gosling. But John Bosnich, I'd like to get this straight because it's confusing, and I'm sure the viewer wants to know this. When you have something like this happen, a documentary being made, and there to be inaccuracies, as the BBC has confessed, it's not as if the person making the documentary just decided on his or her own initiative to include fictional pieces in there. There must have been some directives there. So you got that on the one hand, I'm guessing. And on the other hand, I'm wondering if this is actually happening within the military ranks of the people making decisions, whether they're getting faulty information, whether intended or not. So if you can paint that picture for us.
Sure. First of all, I'd like to congratulate my fellow real journalist for his comments preceding mine, because he's covered all of the key touch points in this story. That's the first point. Secondly, I can share with you my own experience as a war reporter, having covered military conflicts for approximately one decade in various countries. I can tell you that any time that the military-industrial complex of a country can provoke a conflict through the lying mainstream media, and there's a reason why that expression exists, whenever they can do that, it pays very, very well to do so. It not only sells weapons, it continues the basic system of war as the first response. There's no need for an inquiry. There's no need for an investigation, because the media monopolies in the Western warmonger countries, and I'm sorry to say that because I was born in one and grew up in one of those countries, in Canada, but those countries are led by an elite which is responsible to no one. They simultaneously control the military-industrial complex, and they buy up the media through the resources of the military-industrial complex. So what the military-industrial complex does is it provokes incidents. It creates scenarios by which incidents could take place. It hands those scenarios over to its intelligence services like the CIA. As in the case, we can give many instances over the years, but you know, Adolf Hitler used a fake news story about Poland invading Germany in order to start his war on Poland. We know that the Americans used the fake Gulf of Tonkin incident to provoke their entry and their further activity in Vietnam. We know for a fact, I was actually there as a reporter on the scene, that the so-called Racak incident, which was reported as a Serbian massacre in Kosovo, was faked, and we know that it was promoted and called a massacre by the CIA agent operating in Kosovo on behalf of America. So this is not a new tactic. In fact, I would have to say this is the oldest tactic in the book. And the fact that the military-industrial complex is able to so easily infiltrate the media, and that's what they do. They infiltrate the media. There are honest journalists in the media, but they do not control the means of publication. They submit stories, the editors accept or reject the stories, and the stories go forward. When the editors and the publishers get an order from their secret intelligence services telling them that a story needs to be placed, they place it, or they're replaced. That's how the media works in this current system. The media is not responsible to the people, and when the military uses a media fake news, and I want to go further than fake news, because fake news can be intentionally fake, or it can just be fake through incompetence. These incidents are always intentional. They are pre-planned conspiracies to use the media to allow a freedom of hand, a freedom to make war that is not constitutionally available in the countries that make those wars.
Sure.
And that is the main thing that's happening here.
Tony Gosling, you know, this has been rehashed in the past, and that is the role that the OPCW played in this whole alleged chemical attacks, accusing the Syrian government and Russian forces, perhaps, of executing it. And if you can tell us the role that the OPCW played, because there have been obviously allegations made here against them that they have sidestepped concerns about the controversial investigation into that attack, and even accusing the body of accepting unsubstantiated or possibly to have manipulated findings. Do you see the OPCW to be guilty of that?
Well, look, the OPCW is what I would call a point of struggle. It's one of those international organizations which is absolutely critical to stopping this kind of attack, but it's an organization which is very much in the crosshairs of the Western military. They want to control that organization because they know that if they can get them to make statements, I mean, we've seen, for example, the way the International Olympic Committee, as another international body, has been used as a stick with which to beat Russia over doping. All countries pretty much use doping, but Russia was singled out for that purpose because it's part of the Operation Beluga, which is a Western NATO intelligence service operation in order to discredit Putin and discredit Russia in the Western press. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that is going on in the OPCW. But I'd like to also point to the specific organization, the White Helmets, which was used in this documentary. The boss of those supposedly committed suicide, although it looks very clear, if you look at the evidence, that the money for the White Helmets was coming through British intelligence, through MI6, and that this was really just an intelligence front. So what the British intelligence were doing was they created a so-called humanitarian organization equipped with video cameras to go out there and actually to work for British intelligence to deliver stories to the British mainstream news night after night, which would be favourable to the British view that there needed to be regime change in Syria. So this was a propaganda attempt, and this is the information that was picked up partly in this documentary. But more importantly, I'd just like to explain to your viewers how it works here in Britain, that a so-called independent media, state-run media, like the BBC and others, of course, can report in such a biased way a complete fake news story designed to start a war. And that is because we have a unit in Britain called the 77th Brigade, which is a psychological warfare, what they call information operations brigade. It's a rather large army formation put together for psychological warfare purposes. And whilst their own serving members in that brigade and in those offices putting all sorts of fake news out in the mass media and elsewhere and actually on the internet, the idea is also to get people sharing these memes up on social media, is that there are quite a number of retired army officers who are now working within the mainstream press. So, you know, this has happened over the last 50, 60 years. Quite a lot of, for example, from World War II, officers from the forces then went in the 1950s, 60s and 70s to work in the media in Britain. But they are reservists still for the army, and they're working within the media here in the West. And what happens is they get a phone call from the 77th Brigade, hey, we've got a great exclusive for you here, and there it goes, straight into a news bulletin, or a documentary gets commissioned based on what is effectively an army intelligence operation, a military operation, in order to get whatever story it is they want out there. And that, of course, can be a casus belli for a new war. And the idea is really to hoodwink the British public, hoodwink the Western public, for long enough, as long as it takes to commit the crime to get the war started. Sure. And the 77th Brigade have no such oversight such as the BBC have. So I think that the next step really needs to be to get the 77th Brigade to explain its role in this fake news that was also a war crime.
Are the officials known? Are they known to give interviews? Can you make a request? I'm just asking if that's possible or not.
Well, you can make a request, but the idea that they're going to fess up, put their hands up and say, yes, it was us. We used our army officers within the media in order to plant this story. I'm afraid you're going to get nowhere with that sort of request.
Here's the math here, John Bosnich. I was surprised at this. Again, since it's somewhat dated. You have 20 unresolved issues in Syria's chemical weapons file. Declarations that have been made. You have the UN and the OPCW. They have officially attributed 8 of those chemical weapons attacks to the Syrian regime, as they say. So you got 20, 8 of them is towards the Syrian regime. That leaves, 12 that the terrorists have done. So when you take a look at the math there,
even if
and how that's obviously much greater than the 8, if the Syrian government is actually did execute it, it's a huge question mark and a huge doubt on the Syrian government. Because to this day, these Daesh terrorists say there's going to be a chemical attack. Russia makes that announcement Give us your feedback on just this particular piece of stat.
Okay. Of the 20 that you're referring to, I would guess, everything starts with a guess that you have to check, but I would guess that 0 were committed by the Syrian government. Why? Why do I guess that? Because before you analyze, and I worked as a journalist and a government advisor in Canada and in Japan. First, you have to analyze the basic news story and ask yourself, who would benefit from this news? Obviously, the main beneficiaries of any news that Syria is doing anything illegal are the Western NATO powers that were trying to topple illegally by force of arms the government of Syria. So, once we see a news story that only can possibly benefit the opponents of the Syrian government, we have to look at that news story with deep suspicion, because a balanced news story will quote the government in detail, and it will quote the accusers in detail. And if you check the BBC and you check CNN, you will find that, as a general rule, they give 10 times, that's a real figure, 10 times more information against the, and they use the word regime. They don't refer to the Syrian government. So that's a telltale signal right away. The minute you see a report from Western media that refers to the regime of Syria, or the regime of Donbass, or the regime of some place, you know that you're reading a biased report, especially when it refers to English government sources, in the same sentence in which it refers to Syrian government sources as Syrian regime sources. So a cursory glance at a news report will usually tell you whether it's propaganda or not. Then as you go past these first telltale signs, which are always there, then you look to see if they use a resort to authority. So BBC will republish information from Germany, or they will republish information from the CNN, and CNN will republish information from Germany and BBC, and so on, so that they pretend to say, our fellow independent journalists have reported this. And that's always false. Mm-hmm. As a general rule, that's always false.
Okay.
So we've got something that is not just false by accident, it's false by design. And when something is false by design, it should be investigated immediately. And any military action to follow a press report has to be followed first by a public inquiry.
Sure.
Because this carte blanche is the way wars are started, and this is the way millions of people are killed.
Exactly. And that brings me to my last question. Tony Gosselin, something's got to be done. I mean, to carry some placards by some people saying, stop lying or stop this propaganda is not going to be enough, I'm guessing. Because we're looking at a world where there are threats being made. There are threats being made against the Islamic Republic by the U.S., and we know how the U.S. and the U.K. work together. The U.S. focused
damages
on China.
Damages lawsuits.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry to interrupt here, but I think that the proper recourse is to at least sue the BBC for the damages incurred as a result of its false report on the ground in Syria in the World Court. That means tens of millions of dollars of damage, not counting the lives lost.
That sounds like a good idea, even maybe more so if you can tell us, Tony Gosselin, what more can be done. Again, we're looking at a world where there is filled with military thoughts, and it's, a lot of it is coming from the U.S., the focus on China, the threats being made against Iran. Biden just last week used the word options when Naftali Bennett visited him. So what can be done to prevent this, at least for the general public to be aware and to comb their psyche so that they don't fall to the trap of the media like it happened with the BBC doc?
Well, look, it's a very difficult question to answer. What can be done? Because the deep state has a great deal of clout and control of the media, as well as, of course, much of the parliament here in the UK, for example. I think what is a fascinating little smoking gun in this crooked fake news documentary the BBC put out trying to smear Assad is the way they also trying to smear Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in the same report, because as many people know, Julian Assange is on the record as explaining absolutely right and factually that the only way that that wars can start is through lies. And he saw it as his life's mission as an investigative journalist, probably one of the most important publishers on the planet, to scotch those lies. And it's no accident that he is now in jail here in Britain, actually, even though he hasn't actually committed any offence here in the UK. So I think one of the ways we could do something to stop this is to force through legal means or whatever. I don't know how you're going to do it, okay. But to get Julian Assange.
Sorry,
out,
I got to jump in. I do apologize, Tony Gosselin. We're just fresh out of time. But thank you. Some great comments there made by Tony Gosselin, activist, historian, investigative journalist, and a former BBC employee. And thank you so much, John Bosnich, journalist and political analyst. Wish we had more time. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. From Ikara Tafwe, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue our discussion of Imam Khomeini's views on different issues. In today's program, you'll be listening to his advice on the authorities and students of seminaries. Please stay with us. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, had explicated his views on seminaries and presented necessary warnings on the issue during his lifetime. However, this issue is the most important message to the seminaries and to religious scholars of ulama in the waning months of the imam's life. In his message, the imam called the ulama or religious scholars as the carriers and trustees of revelation, which they should strive to guide the people through the content of revelation and what has been bequeathed to us from the Prophet of Islam and his infallible progeny, blessings of God upon them. He writes in his message, "There is no doubt that the seminaries and the committed ulama throughout the history of Islam and Shi'ism have been the most important bastion of Islam against assaults and deviations. The great religious scholars or ulama of Islam have tried through their lifetimes to promote the issues of divine haram or forbidden laws and halal or permitted laws without modification. Had there not been the dear jurisprudence, it was not clear what sciences would have been sold to the masses in the name of sciences of the Quran, Islam, and Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. The collection and preservation of the sciences of the Holy Quran and Islam, and the works and hadiths of the great Prophet, and the practices and behavior of the infallible Imams, peace be upon them, and the registration, compilation, and explication of them under the conditions that there were very little facilities and the rulers and oppressors had employed all their facilities to destroy the works of prophethood was not an easy job. Yet, thank God, today we can see the result of those efforts in the works and books such as Kutub al-Arba'ah, the four main books of Shia seminaries, and other books of the previous and future generations in the fields of jurisprudence, philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, principles of jurisprudence, hadith, history of Islam, exegesis of the Holy Quran, literature, Irfan or Gnosticism, lexicon, and all various fields of sciences. If we do not call this much effort as jihad in the way of God, then what shall we call it? Imam Khomeini continues in his message for ulama and the seminaries. As for the scientific services of seminaries, there is too much to say to the extent that it goes beyond the scope of what can be mentioned here. Thank God the seminaries are rich and innovative from the viewpoint of sources and methods of discussion and ijtihad or independent reasoning on the basis of the Holy Quran and Hadith. I do not think that there can be found a more proper way for deep and comprehensive examination of Islamic sciences than the methods of the preceding ulama. Over 1,000 years of history of research and erudition of true ulama or religious scholars of Islam bears testimony to this claim. This has nurtured the sapling of Islam to flourish. For hundreds of years, the clergy of Islam have been the support of the deprived. The downtrodden have always been satiated by the pure kosar of the teachings of great jurisprudence. Apart from their scientific and cultural struggles, which are superior to the blood of martyrs in some aspects, in every age, they have suffered hardships and bitterness in defense of their religion and patriotic sanctities. And while suffering captivity, exile, prison, imprisonment, harassment, and taunts, they have offered precious martyrs to the divine court. The martyrs of the clergy are not restricted to the martyrs of struggles and the war in Iran. Certainly, the number of anonymous martyrs of seminaries and the clergy who have lost their lives in the path of spreading the divine teachings and divine laws in the hands of mercenaries is very large. In every divine and popular uprising and revolution, the ulama or religious scholars of Islam have been the first who have been martyred. late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, continued by saying, "This does not mean that we defend all clergymen, and the dependent and sanctimonious clergy were not and are not small in number. There are people in seminaries who are active against pure Muhammadian Islam. Today, some people, through sanctimonious posture, are cutting the roots of religion, revolution, and the system in a way as if they had no other duty. The danger of this backwardness and regression is certainly not small. Dear students, should not neglect these colorful snakes for a single moment. These are the promoters of American Islam and the enemies of God's messengers." The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, points to two key methods that are used by enemies in seminaries. The Imam said, "Once the global arrogance was disappointed at complete destruction of the clergy and seminaries, it chose two ways to strike. One was intimidation and coercion, and the other way was deception and infiltration in the contemporary decades. When the weapon of intimidation and threatening was useless, the ways of infiltration was strengthened. The first and most important move was the insinuation of the slogan of separation of religion from politics, which has unfortunately worked to some extent in seminaries and among the clergy so that interference in politics is considered as inferior to the status of the jurisprudent, and entering the arena of politics will cause the accusation of dependence on foreigners. For sure, the struggling clergy have been suffering more from infiltration. Do not think that the accusation of dependence and calumny of irreligiousness have been applied against the clergy only by foreigners. This is not so. The blows of unaware and dependent, aware clergy have been much stronger than those of the foreigners." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, also addressed the clergy in his testimony. The Imam said, "I recommend to the seminaries, as I have repeatedly said, that in this era that the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic have attempted to topple Islam and try in every way to achieve this satanic goal, one of the important ways to this unholy and dangerous end is to infiltrate deviated and wicked persons in seminaries, whose great short-term danger is to scandalize the seminaries with indecent acts and deviated ethics and methods. And the very danger in long-term is to attain high positions by one or a few charlatans who ensconce themselves among the masses and strata of pure-hearted people and make them love them and then deal a fatal blow to the Islamic seminaries and dear Islam and a country at the right moment." Dear listeners, in our next program, we shall continue our discussions today. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.